This is Viewpoint with attorney and author Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is a one-hour open line talk show confronting the issues of America's heart and home. To express your viewpoint, please call 804-754-1988. That's 804-754-1988. And now with today's edition of Viewpoint, here is Chuck Crismeyer.
She said, "I truly believe God makes all things possible. I know that although I live in the projects do not live in me. I have worth and I am not the projects. In my heart, I know that we will move out of the projects one day." Once there was a girl who wanted more than what life seemed to have given her, and she cried out to God, prayed, believed, and God answered her prayers. Our guest today is that girl. And so I welcome you to Viewpoint. I'm Chuck Crismeyer. It's Conversation with Ever-Increasing Conviction, Talk That Transforms. And I think you're going to be stirred in your own mind and heart as we talk with our special guest here, Wendy Reed Randall. But before we get to her, I want to go to several different articles that have come out recently, each one of these from a black spokesperson in our country. The first is Star Parker. Star Parker grew up in very difficult circumstances, very difficult circumstances indeed, and she is black. She says, listening to all the rhetoric in the popular media, you would think America is most unfair, racist nation in the world. You would think that black Americans are uniformly living in oppression and poverty, with no hope for the future except the federal government rising on the scene to rescue. Sorry to trouble you with the facts, but indeed there are facts, and the facts tell a far different story than what we are hearing. Let's start with the most recent annual report of the Census Bureau, Income and Poverty in the United States for 2019. According to this report, real median household income in the U.S. increased 6.8%, but black median household income increased 7.9%. The largest on record. By the way, that was during the Trump administration. Almost nine times the average annual increase over the last half century. Wow. In 2019, 29% of black households had income of $75,000 or more. It was the first time ever that the percentage of high-income black households exceeded the percentage of low-income black households. The Federal Reserve published the Survey of Consumer Finances and covered a three-year period from 2016 to 2019, just prior to the onset of the pandemic. Over that period, black net worth increased 32%, while white net worth increased only 4%. Business equity among blacks during that period increased 138%. In 2018, 37.8% of blacks ages 8 to 24 were enrolled in college, compared with a national average of 40.9% in this age group. Star Parker says, I am trying to divert attention from the many real economic social problems in many black communities. Well, she says, I'm really not trying to divert attention from those real economic and social problems in many black communities. But what I do wish to disabuse is the focus on problems in certain black communities and using this data to generalize about all blacks. It is certainly true, she said, that in 2019, blacks who constituted 13% of the population represented almost 24% of those living below the poverty line. But that isn't about racism. She says the data tells us that this is about family breakdown, not racism. Poverty is excessive in households of all races that are headed by single women. Blacks just happen to have a very high percentage of households headed by single women. By the way, that is 70%. Only 6% of black households headed by a married couple live in poverty. So where problems exist, writes Star Parker, and where progress is disappointing, invariably, government has been the problem, not the solution. I wonder how our guest today will feel about the comments of Star Parker, seeing that our guest today grew up in desperate poverty in the projects in New Orleans. Well, I want to welcome Wendy Reed Randall to our program here today. She wrote a fascinating book, Once There Was a Girl. Normally, I would not have brought this type of book on the program, but quite frankly, I believe that she has something to say to us that can be very encouraging and very helpful for us to somehow reach beyond all of the rhetoric, politicized as it is, and get down to the heart of the matter. So, Wendy, it's so good to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you, Chuck. It's a pleasure to be with you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, you are not in the projects now. You are in Arizona.
That is correct.
And how long has it been since you were out of the projects in New Orleans?
Oh, many, many years. Probably about 36 years or so.
All right. And so you finally gotten around to writing a little memoir concerning your experiences as a girl in the projects. So give us a little context very quickly. Why did you write this book?
Oh, sure. So the catalyst for my writing this book, I was in an online program. I was working on a master's degree in adult education and development.
Well, wait a minute. I thought you were in the projects, and now you're writing a master's thesis?
Yeah, so by the grace of God, I mean, actually, I went to, just to back up a little bit, I went through undergraduate school while living in the projects. So this is some years later when as a mom and, you know, with three children, I decided to further my education. And actually, I had decided before that to try to work on a master's degree in French. But my husband was in the Navy, is retired. And so we got married, we moved to Spain. And so I wasn't able to complete my master's degree from the University of New Orleans in French. I did all the hours, but did not do the thesis. So it stayed in my heart for years to further my education. And given the fact that so many years had passed, I just decided not to pursue the master's in French. And I had a desire to help. I've always had a desire to work with people who are underserved or people who are struggling. So I just, you know, did some research and thought that a master's in adult education seemed like something that I wanted to do. So during the time that I was in this program and an online program, members of my cohort and I, we were given an assignment. And so this assignment, as a result of the assignment, I responded to the assignment by writing a paper entitled Once There Was a Girl. Mm. And so this was a very short paper. I mean, it was just, I don't know, maybe a page and a half thereabouts. Mm-hmm. But I shared a very summarized version of some things that had happened to me, I mean, as you can imagine. And so the response from my cohort was that, oh, that's so inspirational. And, you know, maybe you should consider writing a book. And I said, you know, I took the compliments and stuff and I was, you know, and their comments, and I was really pleased with that. I shared it with my husband. And years passed, you know, I put that idea on the back burner.
And here you are today with the book. We're heading into the break here. We're going to talk more with Wendy and we're going to make her book available to you. I think it'll be a very inspirational read and helpful to understand our times. We'll be right back.
Once upon a time, children could pray and read their Bibles in school. Divorces were practically unknown, as was child abuse. In our once great America, virginity and chastity were popular virtues, and homosexuality was an abomination. So what happened in just one generation? Hi, I'm Chuck Chrismeyer, and I urge you to join me daily on Viewpoint, where we discuss the most challenging issues touching our hearts and homes. Could America's moral slide relate to the Fourth Commandment?
Listen to Viewpoint on this radio station or anytime at saveus.org.
And I welcome you back to Viewpoint. I'm Chuck Chrismeyer. Our special guest today comes right out of the projects in New Orleans. She grew up there and is sharing her experiences here with us today. She didn't stay in the projects, nor did she keep a project mentality. But by the grace of God, that is his favor, and she actually stepped out to make choices. And when she made the choices, God helped her make the necessary changes to be and become the person that he had for her to be, with a beginning in the projects. Wendy Reed Randall, her book, Once There Was a Girl. And this is an $18 book, yours for $17 here on the program here today. It's on our website, saveus.org. That's saveus.org. I urge you to get a copy. Give us a call at 1-800-SAVE-USA. That's 1-800-SAVE-USA. Or write to us at Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia 23255. You're writing a check at $5 for postage and handling, and we'll get the book in your hands. Now, Wendy, one of the things that connects you and me, I didn't grow up in the projects, but I grew up in a pastor's home in a time when pastors were moved around the country about every 2 years. And my father pastored small churches. Oftentimes they were startup churches. And the general mentality within churches at that time was kind of, it went like this: Lord, you keep him humble, we'll keep him poor. Lord, you keep him humble, we'll keep him poor. So we had five kids in our family. And, you know, my mother was an excellent, excellent seamstress. So she was able to go down to a Remnant fabric store and buy fabric at 10 cents on the dollar and make the most amazing clothes. Well, what happened was, you know, the church people looked at that and they go, wow, we must be paying him too much.
Oh, wow.
and yet in Fresno, California, my mother was serving five children in the heat of Fresno, California, out of a little metal ice box that we had to fill every day with ice.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty poor. We're not living in the projects.
Indeed.
So I can relate a little bit, just a smidgen, to your upbringing. But tell us a little bit about the projects there in New Orleans.
I'm sure. So it was a very difficult environment. You know, there were, you would hear gunshots, you know, going off. I mean, you know, there were fights that actually would move, you know, like a fight would start in one court, mm-hmm. and then, you know, travel to another court. And there, and each, as it traveled, you know, it would gather more, you know, people following it.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, situations with alcoholism, substance abuse, just a very noisy environment in which to grow up. You know, there was the opportunity to have like peace and quiet was very difficult to find, you know, but mm-hmm. I found a lot of peace and quiet through reading, you know, and traveling places in my mind.
Well, wait a minute, you sound an awful lot like Dr. Ben Carson. Dr. Ben Carson grew up in some pretty difficult circumstances with a single mom, and she basically wouldn't let him off the hook, and he had to read. He was going to read no matter what, and here he became one of the most famous doctors in the world.
Indeed.
You can be lifted up above your circumstances if you're willing, can't you?
Oh, yes, definitely. You can. I mean, it's about faith, you know, hope and perseverance and mm-hmm. you know, the desire to actually improve your life, you know. And so my mother, you know, she always encouraged us to do the best that we could. And we were poor. We knew we were poor, but mm-hmm. that's not something that she sat around and just discussed with us in the home. I mean, we knew we had meager resources. We were aware of that. But mm-hmm. she just encouraged us to be respectful, you know, to respect ourselves, respect other people, you know, and to just persevere. So that's something that we saw, you know. I just felt like through her prayers that the Lord was moving in our situation, be it very difficult on many days. But, you know, sometimes I just had like a little ounce of hope that we would, that our situation would get better.
Well, the Bible says that hope makes not ashamed. And when we're walking with the Lord in the light of his word, the Bible, the song says, what a glory he sheds on our way. When we do his good will, he abides with us still and with all who will trust and obey. And it seems that your mother was a catalyst for your growing up to eventually embrace Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes, she was that catalyst. We were at church every time the doors opened. We were at church all the time. We spent many, many hours there with her,
mm-hmm.
Traveling on public transportation, no car. We never owned a car. We took public transportation, and whenever we had a little bit extra money, if there was like an emergency situation or some mm-hmm. urgent thing, then she would, gather her coins and a dollar here, and then we would take a taxi or get a ride with, some people who would just park around near bus stops and stuff for people who needed to get somewhere quickly, and you just jump in the car, you give them a few dollars, and they would take you to wherever you needed to go. I guess that was the beginning of the Uber.
There you go. So what was the source of your family income? You had a father, and
yes.
You were not born out of wedlock, were you not?
No, I would say that when I was born, my mother and my father were together, but it's my understanding, because this is something that my mother really didn't talk about, mm-hmm. but it's based upon what I can gather from my birth certificate and all of that, that they got married while she was pregnant with me.
Oh, okay.
At that point.
Okay.
And so then my formidable years, at the very beginning, my father had issues with alcoholism, so mm-hmm. my mother and father were legally separated he came back into our lives when I was around 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So my late father was a janitor and also a waiter. Those were the jobs that he did. He only had an eighth grade education. And my mother did graduate from high school. And so, but my mother, most of our lives was at home with us, and she did odd jobs to earn extra income because mm-hmm. she really wanted to be there to raise us, and that's what she wanted to do. And so we could have maybe benefited had she gone outside of the home.
Mm-hmm.
But she just did odd jobs, babysitting for friends and so forth, and just things here and there.
All right. So what was the primary source of your income?
The primary source of our income was from my father's job.
Mm-hmm.
From the job that he had, and it was very, very little. I mean, mm-hmm. I knew for a fact through my
meager.
Years. Yes, very indeed. We were. I remember finding out that we were below the poverty level. I remember, thing that you get for free lunch that you take home,
mm-hmm.
and the form and all of that. I remember reading the income levels of there, and noting that we were below the poverty level based upon my father's income. So,
what I have learned, interestingly, is that poverty itself does not produce unrighteousness. Poverty itself does not produce a sense of slavery. And the reality is, for a white kid, I basically lived in, I wouldn't call it abject poverty, but it was basically a poverty situation. And all of my friends, my goodness, they seemed to have wheels coming out of the woodwork, multiple cars,
right.
and so on. And I mean, there was nothing they could not afford. And I had basically two shirts, two pair of pants, and two pair of shoes, and that was it.
Wow.
So. Yeah, I have a certain amount of relating to your situation, but not totally, because we didn't have guns going off everywhere. So it appears that whatever circumstances we find ourselves in, it is possible, if we will submit to God, his word, his will, and his ways, that he can lift us out of the miry clay.
Indeed. I'm a living testimony to that and a witness to that. He certainly can.
And that really is the ultimate expression of your book, I think, even though you spend a great deal of time going through the very difficult circumstances. And I like the way you broke things down in these small little mini chapters to help people get an idea of what it's really like, your feelings, the thoughts
right.
that you went through, and so on. But one of the themes that I noticed was continual, and that is, Mama loved going to church, That was the understatement. She took us to church at least twice a week. And I thank God for church, because without it, I would have been stuck in the projects all the time.
Indeed.
That was that your connection to hope, wasn't it?
Indeed, it was. And I remember, you know, even anytime she went, you know, she went to church, we would want to go, you know, like I shared. I mean, it might be because I was bored or what have you, but I did love going to church. And, you know, the people with whom I, some of the people with whom I grew up, you know, we talk about the foundation that we have from the sisters, many of them who are deceased, you know, mm-hmm. who spoke into our lives and helped us, you know. Now, was it a perfect church? No, it was not. Did it have issues? Yes, it did.
Well, no church is perfect. In fact, the moment you walk into it, it's become imperfect, right?
Indeed. I would agree with that 100%.
All right. So now you have some children. How many children do you have?
So my husband and I, we have three daughters. Mm-hmm. Our oldest daughter works for a church, and she's a copywriter. Our middle daughter is a math teacher, and she lives in Guangzhou, China. Mm-hmm. And then our youngest daughter is an aspiring opera singer who's going to a conservatory. Will be moving on to his postgraduate work at a conservatory in Massachusetts.
Now, what conservatory is that?
Longy School of Music.
I wonder if that's where my niece is. She also is an opera singer.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
Very interesting. Uh-huh. Well, you know, and you look at your girls and their experiences, who would have ever thunk it, so to speak? Who would have ever believed that they would be doing that with their mom having been raised in abject poverty in the projects? God has a way, doesn't he?
He certainly does. And as a matter of fact, they were very, all three, including my husband, were very instrumental in you know, like being the beta readers, or, you know, reading my rough draft, encouraging me to complete my book. I mean, each one played that role and said, Bob, you must complete the book. You need to tell your story mm-hmm. and everything. So I'm very thankful that for the support.
I believe you did need to tell your story, and that's why, one of the reasons why I felt very important to bring you on, because in this day and age, when there is so much cacophony, actually, it's very negative. It's it's like the children of Israel coming out of Egypt and then murmuring and complaining because God brought them out.
Indeed.
That really is the black experience right now, I think. And so the murmuring and complaining actually kept them in the spirit of Egypt, and they weren't able to enter the promised land. And I think that's one of the problems that black folk in America are experiencing today.
Right. That is so true. Mm. Because we have many opportunities, you know. And then, like, I believe it starts in the home, you know. It's where, what is going on in the home. You
Absolutely.
Know, that's huge. And that's where we really need to focus. And then also focusing on it, the internal person, what's going on the inside of a person. Mm-hmm. You know, you can give people, you can throw things at people and give them all kinds of things, but what about the person? Do they have any self-motivation? You know, what is their sense of self-worth? You know, what are their mental health issues and so forth? You know, those are things that need to be taken care of. And do they have a sense of self-respect even after they've been given so many things? Mm-hmm. What are they going to do with it? How do they feel about being given things rather than, you know, in certain situations, really having to strive and work for it?
Well, you know? And of course, that leads us again to what happened in 1964 with the Civil Rights Act. And then, corresponding to that, the Lyndon Baines Johnson so-called War on Poverty that did more to seduce black America into poverty and the destruction of the black family than anything in history, I think.
Right. Indeed. It certainly did. I mean, in our situation, I remember when my father came back into our lives, my mother said that people were telling her to not report to the authorities that there was a man in the home, which was, you know, she said that that's not something that she wanted to do. Now, economically, I mean, she still would have been getting the welfare check, because when we first moved into the project, my father was not there.
Right.
But then he came back to our lives, and so legally she was obligated to, you know, and
but
morally.
But your mother was honest. We'll pick up on that after this break, friends. This is very important. We'll be right back.
There is so much more about Chuck Crismeyer and Save America Ministries on our website, saveus.org. For example, on the front page are two great videos. First, an interview and discussion of Chuck's book, Out of Egypt. Also, a great TV interview with Chuck regarding his book, Seduction of the Saints. Much more videos, a For Pastors Only section, and also you can view Chuck's weekly teachings, all at his website, saveus.org. That's saveus.org. Also on Chuck's website, listen to Chuck's Viewpoint broadcast. Listen to the archives. Maybe you missed a program. Check it out at saveus.org. Also, there are some great resources, hospitality information, also information about marriage, divorce, and remarriage, newsletters, articles, prophecy, prayer and revival information, all at saveus.org.
Did the government seduce black America into slavery? That's an interesting question. It's a rhetorical question for all of us, because Lyndon Baines Johnson actually purposely set up an alternative to the previous thoughts of the Democratic Party concerning how to reach the black community, and they were not being successful because they were the party of slavery. And so he conceived this idea, well, if we can't beat them, we'll join them, so to speak. And what we're going to do, we're going to offer them a lot of money. We're going to offer them a lot of money and seduce them into dependency on the Democratic Party or the Democrat Party. And that's exactly what he did through the war on poverty. And our guest today was just saying before the break that when her father came back into the home, her mother had a choice. Do I report the fact that the man, the father, is back in the home, which will cut off the funds flowing from the federal government that is trying to seduce us into dependency, or not, and keep the funds flowing? That was the choice. It was a moral choice. But you know what? I have a feeling, Wendy, that that moral choice that your mother made, God looked upon that choice and said, that's my daughter. That is my daughter. She is my child, and I'm going to bless her and her progenies because of it. What say you?
I agree 100%. Yes, indeed. I mean, you know, she shared that, and we, and when she shared that, I mean, as a child, you think, well, you know, we don't have very much food. We're often struggling. But then, I, you know, I remember her telling me, and then I respected what she said, you know, and we continued to struggle, you know, after my father came into the home. And I share my story that, you know, I felt that that might, that we might move out of the project when he returned. But economically, that was not feasible, you know. And we actually, I mean, we were actually charged, not a whole lot, but, you know, when my father came back into the home, we had to pay a certain amount, you know, she had to pay rent. To live in the project, to continue living in the projects, but that is all that we could afford, you know, based upon what my father's, his earnings at the time.
Yeah. In New Orleans, death was a very common occurrence in your neighborhood, wakes and funerals. I understand the reports within the inner cities of America. You hear the reports from Chicago every weekend, dozens of people shot. And you experienced that. How did that affect you?
It was very difficult. I had a sense of, you know, I live with a sense of fear. You know, for example, going to bed at night, there would be times when I would think that I was always hearing like someone was breaking in. I had a fear of, you know, someone breaking in, or, you know, just being a victim of some type of crime.
Right.
But my mother, you know, she said, she always said, pray, you know, just pray. And so, pray I did, but I still struggled.
Isn't that life struggle, though? We are called to live by faith. The just shall live by faith. But we also have a corresponding assault of fear and so on that comes to us, anxiety and fear, and even the more so right now, all over the world.
Indeed.
Jesus
That's
himself
correct.
Said that before the second coming, men's hearts would fail them for fear for the things that are coming upon the earth. So in the midst of fear, your mother constantly instilled faith in spite of the fact that the bullets were whistling around.
That is correct. Yes, I would walk past her. I would see her, my sisters and I, we would see her on her knees. And she would be there for such a long time. And you know, and I've shared that I thought that she had fallen asleep. I didn't know what was going on. And now, as a mom, you know, many years, I can certainly understand and appreciate it. And like you shared, given that the situation in which we find ourselves, you know, all over the world. I mean, prayer does indeed change things. I mean, that's the time when you communicate with God. You know, that's where your faith is built up. So my seeing her, you know, obviously that made an impression upon me. And so, you know, now I pray, and I always encourage my daughters to do the same. You know, I'm really thankful that my mother prayed for us, because she apparently, you know, as she had a lot to pray for, you know,
to raise
three daughters. And, you know, I had, like many children, I had issues, you know, the things she had to deal with. And, you know, she had to surround us with prayer just to protect us from just our environment. You know, I can only imagine how it was for her to, you know, to raise three daughters in that particular environment.
Well, we raised three daughters as well, but not in that particular environment. But I'll tell you, even in the midst of Christian schools and homeschooling and all of the things that we did, we had to pray for them triple time, because the spirit of our age is intent on snuffing out their life, snuffing out their spiritual hope, isn't it?
Indeed. It certainly is that case. And that, you know, you just, my heart goes out to children who are growing up in a similar environment, but just children who are growing up all over the world, you know, and dealing with the things that we are facing, you know, presently.
Right.
But, you know, prayer changes things. And so my encouragement to everyone listening is to really pray and communicate with the Lord and believe that God does indeed answer prayers.
And that's not a matter of the color of our skin, is it?
And no, it has nothing to do with that.
So your melanin quotient has nothing to do with whether God hears your prayer.
No, and it has nothing to do either with whether you struggle or not. You know, the fact is everyone struggles. We all have issues. We all have struggles that we have to go through. Even
That's
if
right.
you are financially successful, that doesn't mean that you don't have concerns and problems that you're facing.
Well, even some people that are extraordinarily financially successful, you find them committing suicide. Why is that? Because they're not happy. They're not fulfilled.
That's correct.
And you write in your book, happiness is so fleeting and unpredictable. It would be hard to say that in the midst of the project you were happy, but
correct.
You were, and your family was seeking to be holy. And because of that, God never called us to be happy, did he? He called us to be holy.
No, he did not.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
Yeah. So God will honor that. Them that honor me, I will honor, God said. And your mother led the way. How about your father? Did he serve as in any way as a spiritual leader in your home?
Yes, he did. He was, I would say he was like a quiet, steady source. I mean, he worked to provide for us, you know, the best that he could. I remember, you know, he would get paid on a Thursday when I don't know which job it was, the janitor or the waiter. But anyway, he would come home. We had no car, so he would have two bags of groceries. He'd have one in his arm, holding in his arms. And then the other one, you know, he would just be, one arm would have one bag of groceries. The other arm, he would have another
bag.
Well,
he didn't have a lottery ticket in the third arm, did he?
No, he never can.
So in other words, he wasn't going to depend on some other exterior source to provide him hope.
No, he did not. You know, he did not. He was a very respectful person, and he had a lot of friends that, you know, he loved to fish. So my father, he provided for us through his fishing. He loved to fish, and so thankfully he was a fisherman, and he would actually walk to the over to from our apartment in the project. He would walk to his fishing spot, which is off the Industrial Canal in New Orleans, and he would come home with with whatever fish he caught. Usually, he caught catfish and croaker and so forth. And so that
was what you guys were known for, is catfish down there.
Indeed, and we were eating catfish, you know, all the time, because that was our protein.
You didn't grow any kind of weird whiskers out of it, did you?
No, but I did. But he did fillet, because we were children. He was excellent at filleting the fish. He actually was a great cook, and so he was excellent at filleting the fish for us, and you know, for other fish, he taught us how to, you know, get deal with the bones and all of that. So
now, did he Cajunize it?
Yes, he did.
Well,
he
good
did.
For
he was,
him.
Yes, he did.
I like Cajun fish. That's all right. Now, your book, Once There Was a Girl, is a memoir. It's written in such a way that it catches the heart, the intention of a girl growing up in the projects, and helps us to understand, to get a better picture of what that is like, rather than listening to the whining and the complaining of people out there, and particularly white people that are out there trying to declare how horrible black life is. There's something strange about what's going on. Do you think so?
Yes, I do. I think there is something strange.
Well, give us your perspective on that quickly.
I feel like it's trying to take us backwards. You know, we have achieved so much, mm-hmm. you know, and things have, you know, we've been so blessed in our country in many ways, and it's taken us backwards, and it's starting to, you know, it's making people, it's encouraging people to have a victim mentality.
And to develop hatred, not only of blacks toward whites, but of whites toward themselves.
Indeed. Because, you know, my mother, I was raised, you know, back in the time when things were a lot different. Mm-hmm. But my mother, in our home, that was not something she talked about. She never said, it's because you're black. Mm-hmm. This is what's happening. Mm-hmm. We talk about that. We never even thought about that. I mean, that mm-hmm. was not something that we discussed. Now, we knew that there were issues in the country,
right.
but that was not something that we carried around. We didn't carry that weight of, uh-huh. you know, we didn't feel that we were victims. We actually felt that we could do whatever, we could achieve our goals, because that's how we were raised.
So you were a human yeah. being. Your mother treated you like a human being made in the image of God. And it wasn't about the color of your skin. It was about the color of your character.
Indeed. That was huge. She was a huge proponent, and she, you know, she exemplified such, I mean, the manner in which she treated others. You mm-hmm. know, she shared that at one point they wanted to put us, our little family, in the newspaper because of, you know, they saw my mom and walking around and how she, you know, raised us and all of that. And there's a little thing, communication that they did in the project, and they wanted to feature our family. And she said that she declined because she didn't want us to be, you know, singled out for, you know, she didn't want us to have any problems as a family.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she was a person who really believed in showing forth the love of Christ to others, respecting yourself, respecting others, you know, and just working to be the best person that you could be, even if you don't have the money. I remember her sharing that. She said it's about who you are on the inside, because we would complain about not having the latest fashions or what have mm-hmm. you, and she wasn't about that life. We just wore what she was a seamstress also. She had those skills, and so she would, you know, buy fabric and make a thing here
so
and there.
So we did have a lot in common then.
We did, indeed.
All right, here it is. Once There Was a Girl, I'm a Boy, but this is about Wendy, and I want to urge you to get her book. We'll talk about it right after this program.
Have you ever considered what the early church was like? Many people are developing a heart longing for greater fulfillment in our practices as Christians. A recent study showed 53,000 people a week are leaving the back door of America's churches in frustration. What is going on? Why has there not been even a 1% gain among followers of Christ in the last 25 years? Could it be that God is seeking to restore first century Christianity for the 21st century? Jesus said, I'll build my church. Is Christ by his Spirit stirring to prepare the church for the 21st century? The early church prayed together and broke bread from house to house. They were family, and it was said by all who observed, behold how they love one another. Incredible.
But the same can be found right now. Go to saveus.org and click Sell Church. We can revive first century Christianity for the 21st century.
It's about people, not programs. It's about a body, not a building.
That's saveus.org. Click Sell Church.
What a privilege it is to come before you each day to confront the deepest issues of America's heart and home from God's eternal perspective. We do that here on Viewpoint every single day. Our viewpoint concerning life, our viewpoint concerning our circumstances, the circumstances that we're dealt in our sojourn upon this planet determine our destiny. They really do. Attitudes matter. They really do. It's not just about actions, it's about attitudes. And our guest today, Wendy Reed Randall, has displayed that also with regard to her mother and her father, their attitudes that enabled their family even to stand out in the projects. And her book, Once There Was a Girl. It's an $18 book, yours for $17. It's on our website, saveus.org. That's saveus.org. Give us a call at 1-800-SAVE-USA, 1-800-SAVE-USA, or write to us at Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Again, if you're writing a check, at $5 for postage and handling. On our website, friends, are a whole series of fact sheets. I think there are about 10 of them. One of them that I believe the Holy Spirit urged me to begin to put together back in 2005 to plead the Lord's cause in the land on behalf of Black America. It's called A Portrait of the Black Family. A Portrait of the Black Family. And every single quote there on that 4 or 5 page fact sheet is from a Black columnist or spokesperson, and it is profound. You want to find out what the problems are? Go to that fact sheet. It'll lead you to prayer for a year. One Black pastor told me that that fact sheet was the most powerful tool he had ever found to preach righteousness in the Black community. A Portrait of the Black Family. But leading off in that portrait is a statement from the head of a Black think tank in San Francisco back around 2000. Anyway, he said this, and this was in the 50th anniversary edition of Ebony Magazine, written by Blacks for the Black community. He said that the Black community and the family had deteriorated more in the last 30 years, as of that time, than in all of the 14 generations since slavery. That's what he said. Why? What is responsible for that deterioration? I think we've talked a bit about it here, but perhaps our guest Wendy Randall has something further to say. What say you, Wendy?
I say that the deterioration has been one reason was that there's no father in the home for in many situations.
Hallelujah, you have spoken right to the heart of the matter. No wonder God, in his mercy, told Malachi the prophet to warn Israel that before the great and terrible day of the Lord, he would send forth the spirit of Elijah the prophet to call the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers. He knew what it was going to be like in this generation, didn't he?
Indeed, he did. He definitely knew.
That is the number one issue. In fact, even secular observers, Wendy, are saying that it is the number one social problem in our country and that virtually all of the negative statistics, social statistics in our country can be linked directly to fatherlessness.
Indeed, because the father plays a significant role, you know, in the home. And I'm very thankful that the Lord enabled us, you know, as poor as we were, but we had our father, you know, in the home, and that was very, very important to us.
Yeah. Well, that is, thank you so much for speaking directly to that issue. And when you find that 70% of Black children are born out of wedlock, it is devastating, isn't it?
It is indeed devastating, and you're welcome.
All right. Now, you have indicated that you came to the Lord. When would you say that you yourself made a commitment to Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior?
I would say that I made a commitment when I was around 27 years old.
Now, okay.
Yes, when I was 9 years old, I was baptized in the church, and I followed, you know, my friends in baptism.
Sure.
It was a tradition of the church, and so I made the assumption for many years that I was, you know, saved, that I had accepted the Lord. However, I had gone through that act, and I equated being baptized with salvation, and good works for many, many years until, you know, at the age of 27, my husband and I were discussing that while we were stationed in Rota, Spain, and he said, do you remember when you were saved? And I said, well, I was baptized at the age of 9. And he said, well, what about when you were saved? And so we had a discussion. And so, I just decided to, you know, rededicate my life in a sense. And I chose to be baptized again, not that I had to or anything, but it was something that I chose to do. And at Bethel Baptist Church, a church that ministered to the military in Rota, Spain,
well,
I was baptized
Bethel,
again.
That means the house of God.
Indeed. So, yes. But, you know,
well, what are you doing in Spain?
My husband was on active duty in the Navy, and so right after we were married, we moved to Spain. And so I've lived outside of the country. I've been blessed to travel around the world, and I love traveling around the world. I love other cultures and languages and so forth. So
well, obviously you do, because you speak French and Spanish fluently, I understand.
Right. Yes. And so it depends on the day, but usually I end up. I just was speaking Spanish last night, as a matter of fact, at a I was picking up some tacos, and so I had an opportunity to speak to the guy.
So when in a Hispanic community you speak with Hispanics, when in the French community you speak with the French.
Indeed, I endeavor to do that. I love connecting with people, and since I don't have the opportunity all the time, or you know, I don't speak it every day, but when I have the chance, I want to maintain my language skills, and they are so important. And I pray that, you know, the Lord opens the door for my book to be, you know, translated into Spanish and into French at some point, you know, because I have a desire to, you know, share my story around the world. And
absolutely. And it's a wonderful story. It really is. And that's why I was determined. We got to get this girl on this program here today. A fellow by the name of Scott Lively, a pastor, said the great equalizer of humanity is the gospel of Jesus Christ. And
indeed,
he said that. That was the opening statement in a letter that he sent out called An Open Letter to Black Christians. The great equalizer of humanity is the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's not
right.
A matter of skin. It's a matter of sin, isn't it?
It is. That is correct. It is. It is a matter of sin. It's not a matter of skin, you know, because we're all the same on the inside. I mean, God is, you know, we have our skin covers us, you know.
Well, wait a minute. If you get cut, what color is the blood?
Red.
And then the scripture says that we're of one blood in Christ, doesn't it?
It does.
So why is it that we keep talking about being separate? And now in our culture, guess what? They used to cry separate but equal. Now, then they cried equal, or now they're crying equal but separate. Go figure. What
yes.
is this about?
It's just mass confusion, and it's just adding a lot of angst where there just doesn't need to be, you know, to our world, to our society. And it's happening, you know, in pockets around the world, you know, where people are going backwards for some reason. And it's just, I didn't think that I would ever live to see such a day, you know, that
exactly.
we in which we find ourselves.
Even though you grew up in the projects, what you're seeing today in many respects is worse, isn't it?
It is. It is, because, you know, people are now there's such hopelessness. I mean, it's not really solution focused. It's just kind of, you know, regurgitating a lot of the same old things and saying the same old things and trying to indoctrinate people. So people then start to lose hope. And you think about children. I mean, if you're continually told these things, then you start to believe that it's true.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate so much your being frank, your being honest. You actually graduated with honors, magna cum laude, with a Bachelor of Arts degree in French. So you're still speaking un peu de français, parlez-vous
oui,
un
peu de français, oui, de parle français.
Je vais bien, merci, and all of that.
Oui. D'accord.
Well, that is great. And what took you to France?
So what took me to France was I was, you know, without sharing the whole story, but I was blessed to have the opportunity, you know, to go to France, through, you know, after being a participant in the French club. So miraculous intervention, totally miraculous. I was able to go to France and just to study more of the language in a short trip. And then years later, I went back to France two times on scholarships given to students from the Council. CODEFIL is the Council for the Development of French in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And so I was blessed. And so I just, from the first time I went to France, I just developed a love for the culture and the French people. And, of course, French is actually the official language of Louisiana. And so I just, you know, I just worked to maintain those skills. You know, I greatly, you know, want to always continue to speak French, and I love it when I encounter people.
And what are you doing now, other than what you're speaking? What are you doing now?
So presently, I'm working actively promoting my book and, you know, interviewing and connecting mm-hmm. with certain entities around the country to share my story. Mm-hmm. My desire is to, you know, hopefully have my story be included in a curriculum, you know, of schools, you know, around the country. Mm-hmm. I've been blessed to have one school put it into the 11th grade English, you know, they will use it in the 11th grade English program. So I've been really blessed. So that's my desire, to do this full time, to share the message behind my story, for, you know, to have speaking engagements and so forth. But I am, you know, certified as a teacher, and, you know, I'm a former substance abuse counselor, so I've done those jobs also, because I just have a desire to help people. So
sure.
Kind of mix the languages and the social services and the education together, and yeah. There I am.
And your husband?
My husband's retired from the Navy, and so he's in evangelistic work, and so he retired as a command master chief, and so we were, like I shared, we're able to travel all over the country, so that's what he's doing. At one point, he was active in politics in North Carolina. He was active in politics, and so he mm-hmm. ran for Congress.
Oh, wow. Our current putative president doesn't want Christians in the military. He's doing everything he can to get them out of the military. Did you know that?
Yeah, and it's very sad, you know, because we were there when he was on active duty. That is what helped us. It was the Christian community mm-hmm. that helped us, you know, being so far away from home, especially when you're overseas. And so that faith community was such a blessing to me, especially, you know, being overseas as a young mom. And I wouldn't have made it without them, to tell you the truth.
Well, you're a blessing to all of us, and I want to conclude our program here today by going back to read the words just before the words "the end" in your book.
Sure.
I truly believe God makes all things possible. I know that although I live in the projects do not live in me. I have worth. I am not the projects. In my heart, I know that we will move out of the projects one day. Once there was a girl who wanted more than what life seemed to have given her, but she cried out to God and prayed, believed, and God answered her prayers. I am that girl. What a beautiful statement. It makes me think of, you know, Joshua and Caleb coming out of Egypt. There were 3 million or 22.5 million Hebrews that came out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And God was leading them on to a place called the Promised Land. But only 2 out of 600,000 men that God took out of Egypt, only 2 of them were allowed into the Promised Land, because they had another spirit. They had another heart. Their names were Joshua and Caleb. And I think you're a female version. You're a female version.
Thank you.
Because you have that other spirit. Thanks for sharing it with us here today on Viewpoint again, the book Friends, Once There Was a Girl. Inspire your friends with it. Get the message out. Bring hope in the midst of the horror of our time. $17. We'll put it in your hands. It's on our website, saveus.org. Saveus.org. Give us a call at 1-800-SAVE-USA or write to us at Save America Ministries. And when you do, consider giving a gift. You see, that's the only way we're able to stay on the air. We've been on for 26 years now, confronting the deepest issues of America's heart and home from God's eternal perspective. God bless and pray for Wendy as she continues on to do what God has called her to do in this difficult hour of history. God bless and be a blessing.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Chrismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.